Hello and welcome to the Muni Lowdown Podcast. My name is Paul Graves and I'm the managing editor for DebtWire Municipals. Today, we're going to be talking about a very interesting topic, Puerto Rico. The title of today's podcast is Puerto Rico's Restructuring, Is It Enough? So we have a couple of regular guests, that being Greg, our head of research. Greg, how are you doing?
I'm good, Paul. How are you?
I'm doing all right. And we also have from sunny Florida, as she likes to remind us all the time, Simone Barbeau. How are you, Simone?
Doing well this morning.
But even though I love Greg and Simone, today is a very, very special day because we have a great friend of the program, full transparency, a former staff member at DebtWire Municipals, one Senior Javier Balmaceda. Javier, how are you doing today?
I'm good, Paul. I used to be a regular guest here, too.
Yes, you were. Yes, you were. And you moved on to bigger and better things. You are now a senior policy analyst at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. And maybe you can talk a little bit more about your role there and just give us your background in general for others that may not be as familiar with you as us as we are.
Sure, Paul. First of all, I was born and raised in Puerto Rico. So I'm from the place that we'll be talking about today. And I've been working at the Center on Budget for about 5 years now as a senior policy analyst. The center, for those unfamiliar, is a think tank based in Washington, D.C. It's been around for about 40 years now. It started in 81. And the main focus that we have at the think tank is essentially a budgetary one. We look at the federal budget, specifically at all the major health and economic security programs, and we make sure that these programs are adequately funded, because we believe that essentially the safety net is incredibly important. It's essential for many folks here in the country and in the territories to have a dignified life. And so for the past 5 years, we've been doing a pretty intense analysis on Puerto Rico and the other territories to see how all these major programs like Medicaid, SNAP, which is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, all sorts of tax credits and other programs that help folks apply in Puerto Rico or don't apply, as many of these programs are. They exist in Puerto Rico, but in a limited fashion. Some of them are not even extended to Puerto Rico. And so we've been trying to find ways in which the federal government can bridge those gaps. Prior to that, I studied public policy at the University of Chicago and the University of Chile. And I have a bachelor's in political science from Williams College. Last but not least, as you mentioned at the beginning, Paul, and I think the most valuable experience of all is having worked as a reporter for many years. I worked for 4 years at DebtWire. It gave me all the in-depth knowledge of bonds and restructuring and all the things we're going to talk about today in more depth, specifically Puerto Rico's bankruptcy, which is just now winding down, coming to an end.
Thank you, Javier, for the kind words. Typically, we wouldn't go into asking about your background in such an extensive way, but it seems very relevant to the conversation we're going to have today. And I'd like to take a moment to just go over a brief outline of events that have happened over the last 8 years. And from there, I'll lead that into another question for you, Javier. So if we rewind to June of 2015, the governor at that time, Alejandro Garcia Padilla, makes this statement to the New York Times, the debts are not payable and they're in a debt spiral and the economy cannot support the debt and we need to position the economy so it can grow. In the following year, June 2016, PROMESA is signed, the Puerto Rico Oversight, Management and Economic Stability Act by Congress, as many of the same bankruptcy slash Chapter 9 provisions creates a structure for adjustment of debt. It creates an oversight board, creates the ability to expedite energy projects. We move again, January of 2017, Governor Ricardo Rosselló is elected into office. And I should mention that Governor Padilla was part of the Popular Democratic Party, and Governor Rosselló was elected from the other main party down in Puerto Rico, the New Progressive Party. So we move forward again, May 2017, Chief Justice John Roberts assigns Judge Laura Taylor Swain to the Puerto Rico restructuring cases. In September of 2017, Hurricanes Irma and Maria levy catastrophic damage on the island. Then we move to the next governor that comes in, Governor Rosselló, who has to resign under a cloud of scandal in July of 2019. He's trying to get one of his officials, Pedro Pierluisi, to be appointed to the office. The territory Supreme Court nullifies that move. So then Wanda Vasquez becomes the governor. Then she's unseated by the current governor, which is Pedro Pierluisi from back in 2019. And in between that, there was also a major earthquake that happened on the island. And last but not least, there was a pandemic. So a lot of things going on here, Javier, in addition to debt trouble, economic trouble. As we look at where things stand for Puerto Rico now, has it been enough?
Nice and easy question. The short answer is no. I think some of it is due to the oversight boards. And again, as you mentioned, the oversight board was instituted in 2017 as a result of PROMESA, the federal law. And I think the board has had to produce all these fiscal plans that serve as a blueprint for Puerto Rico's restructuring. And also, they include long-term projections about Puerto Rico's economy and its performance. And I think from the get-go, starting in 2017, 2018, really, which is when they released the first certified fiscal plan, they had a pretty optimistic slash ambitious view of Puerto Rico's future. And on that vision, which is rather quixotic, they based a lot of the restructuring deals. When I say optimistic, I'm specifically pointing to the impact that the board thought different structural reforms would have on the economy. The board came in, and in addition to being the debtor for Puerto Rico and the bankruptcy cases, it also produced fiscal plans, and in them included its vision of what Puerto Rico should do in terms of government and public sector, and even sometimes private sector, to improve the performance of its economy and thereby be able to pay debts and also grow economically. And they included a series of structural reforms, which is what they call them. And these include everything from human and capital, welfare reform, K through 12 education reform, ease of doing business, power sector reform, which is a big one. And initially, the board was projecting that combined, these reforms would have a pretty massive impact on Puerto Rico's gross national product. If you look at the 2018 fiscal plan, the first one ever, they predicted that it would grow the GNP by 1.8%. But if you look at the latest fiscal plans, they have cut those forecasts for the same reforms to about 0.75%. So based on the board's own fiscal plans, you can tell that there's been a pretty drastic turn towards a more conservative outlook of Puerto Rico's economy. To be fair to the board in 2017, the one that had no knowledge of what would happen, I think no one could have predicted that Puerto Rico would go through the absolute ringer in the next 6 years. I mean, talk about the perfect storm. As you mentioned, we had bankruptcy followed almost immediately by two devastating hurricanes. There was civil unrest, massive protests leading up to the ousting of a governor. There was the federal government, too, that didn't respond very well immediately after the hurricanes. You know, President Trump and the bureaucracy of the federal government made it really hard to move funding to Puerto Rico, disaster recovery funding. And then, you know, to boot, you had earthquakes in early 2020, immediately followed by a global pandemic. And on top of that, and this is, I think, is the most important point, is you have systemic things that have always been affecting Puerto Rico. And I think this is where the board maybe was too optimistic. Even before all these exogenous shocks, Puerto Rico in 2017 was already one of the poorest jurisdictions in the United States. It had a poverty rate well above 40%, and that's been true for many decades. It had a very low labor participation rate, and it was on about year 11 of an economic recession. So even going into it, the board, I think, had all these indicators that Puerto Rico's economy was not performing well. It hadn't been for many decades, even before the exogenous shocks that we just talked about. And I think they sort of overplayed the performance of the economy and many of the deals that they struck, particularly the deals on COFINA, which is based on the sales tax, and general obligation bonds. In my view, and the view of many other economists, was overly optimistic.
Javier, this is Greg. Let me ask you a question. If the economy grew at the rates that it was projected to grow at back in 2017, 18, around there, do you think the debt would be more manageable and payable? Or was it just too much debt in the restructuring from the outset?
I think to some extent, yes. I mean, there's a big difference between a growth of 1.8% of a GNP versus what they're now predicting, which is half of that, less than half of that. But I think even with growth, if you look at the long-term projections from the board itself in the first fiscal plan, they were already predicting that Puerto Rico's economy would eventually slump. It would go into deficits. Right now, I think the most serious concern is that with everything that's happened and in the latest fiscal plan, the board is predicting that Puerto Rico is going to run into deficits again as soon as fiscal year 32-33. They're predicting that by then Puerto Rico is going to have a deficit of about $1.5 billion. It's going to grow again in 37, 5 years later, to 2.6. In fiscal 42, it's going to grow to 3.9, 4.6, and by 52, it's going to be 6 billion in the red. So there's something inherently wrong with the economy if you have long-term projections that always seem to show a downward trend. Those stats, by the way, are in the board's own fiscal plan and the newest plan on volume two. And there's a combination of factors, but the truth about the trends is that it was always going to trend downwards. And there are concerns that by, again, in this case, you know, fiscal 32, which is in 9 years, just 9 years, Puerto Rico is going to be running deficits again, and it won't be able to pay its share of its debt. And it's concerning because debt loads are only going to increase in Puerto Rico at least to fiscal 40, fiscal year 40. Mainly due to general obligation and COFINA bonds, which have a combined increasing debt load
right
to fiscal 40. So,
regarding the structural reforms to the government that the board suggested in general, how far along do you think the government has gone in implementing those? And, you know, a related question, were the board's recommendations worthwhile?
Yes, I think some of the board's recommendations were good. I think structural reforms like ESA doing business, trying to change the Department of Education in Puerto Rico, which is a very messy bureaucracy, those were pretty good reforms. Others, I think, not so much. I think the board might have been, I don't know what the right phrasing is, but maybe overly punitive when it comes to accountability in some instances. In others, I think they were right. I think Puerto Rico did need better accounting systems. I don't know that it was much to do with transparency. There certainly is a dose of corruption in Puerto Rico, but I mean, I think it's comparable to other jurisdictions in the United States, and it's also hard to measure corruption. But I think Puerto Rico had outdated systems, and I think the board came in, and to their credit, they tried to improve Puerto Rico's accounting systems. And I think that's helpful. And again, a lot of that is the product of a lack of investment and the poverty and an economic depression. Not really. It's not a recession anymore. All these factors contribute to a government that can't properly fund its operations. And so you have a deterioration of all kinds of functions in government, including the way you account for different things. And so the board came in and I think Some of the reforms they pitched were good, some not so much. You asked me, have some of these actually progressed? Yes and no. Again, the answer is yes and no. I think in terms of accountability, in terms of budgeting, in terms of producing financial statements, everything that has to do with accountability, I think there's been a market improvement. Puerto Rico is almost up to speed again with its audited fiscal statements, financial statements. The accounting systems are better. The budget process moves a little quicker. And I think there's a higher awareness of where Puerto Rico is spending or allocating different budget items. And I don't know that that was necessarily true before, at least not immediately before. It was a time where Puerto Rico did government right, where government was properly funded and there was the money and the resources to do this the right way. But again, when you have a government that's in shambles, you can't really expect a good performance from it.
Well, all right. So there's obviously bondholders that are involved in this restructuring as well. And Simone, you've been covering these filings and these hearings for years now. What's your sense of the bondholders' perspective to what's been going on with the restructuring?
In terms of the growth models, bondholders experts are definitely skeptical of the oversight board's models. Basically, they're saying they are really overly pessimistic. And if I could read a quote from Sebastian Edwards, he's a bondholder expert, and he's also the World Bank's former chief economist for Latin America and the Caribbean. He said, through a combination of flawed economic modeling and unreasonably pessimistic assumptions about the impact of restructuring and reforms, the board generates a prediction that Puerto Rico's economy will languish in economic decline and never recover. If that happens, it will be unique in modern economic history. In my opinion, that is not a realistic outcome. And again, this was the World Bank economist opinion. He also said that contrary to economic evidence, the board assumes a long-term decline in capital stock in Puerto Rico that, were it to actually occur, would be an extreme outlier and similar only to the experience of countries suffering from economic collapse. When bondholders look at the oversight board's new predictions, they're basically saying, you know, this is unrealistic. You're saying Puerto Rico has problems. Puerto Rico has obviously has a high rate of poverty. It's had that for a long time. But what you're seeing here would be different from virtually any country if the oversight board's predictions are correct. Now, obviously, bondholders are not happy right now because, in addition to everything else with the Puerto Rico Electric Power Authority bonds, and I'm talking about Puerto Rico Electric Power Authority bondholders, those are the only ones that are in Title III, but the Title III hasn't come to resolution. So in addition to all the problems they have with their bonds being found as unsecured, and they don't even have an unsecured claim on the full face value of the bonds, the pie that the oversight board has said exists to pay all creditors was cut in basically half when they came out with their new fiscal plan a few weeks ago.
So, Javier, we've provided some perspective on the ground for Puerto Rico in terms of the economy and what's been happening over the last few decades. Simone just provided us some bondholder perspective. But as we look forward, if you were able to be in charge of this restructuring ship, what would your recommendations be to get Puerto Rico on sustainable fiscal and economic footing?
I think the first recommendation would be to make sure that all the federal funding that's coming in now to Puerto Rico is used wisely, to make sure that investment has the best bang for your buck. And here I'm referring to both disaster recovery funding and also funding that will come from all these pretty expansive, fiscally expansive laws that have been approved by the U.S. In the past three years or so. We're talking about $70 to $90 billion that are coming into Puerto Rico. It's a pretty sizable amount. And there's the opportunity to use that money to invest in certain businesses and industries and incentivize a good performance for Puerto Rico's economy. Again, this is, you know, a lot of it is one-time funding, particularly the disaster recovery funding. It's funding that only comes once and then it goes away. So I wouldn't tell you that it is enough, but it's a good amount of money. And if you make sure that you invest it wisely, it can have a pretty major impact on your outlook. I think the second part of this, or the second recommendation, has to do with understanding that there are a lot of systemic faults in Puerto Rico, things that long predate the bankruptcy. We talked about chronic poverty rates, low labor participation rate. If you talk to most economists and experts in Puerto Rico, they will tell you that Puerto Rico's amazing story of economic success that began in the 50s didn't really end in 2006 or the late 90s. It actually ended in the mid 70s. So long before most people tend to think that Puerto Rico's downward slump began. And the reason for that is that Puerto Rico's economy was on par. It was catching up to the U.S. throughout the 50s and the 60s. But starting in the mid 70s, things changed quite dramatically. And Puerto Rico's economy again started to diverge from the path that the U.S. economy as a whole was on. And so you look at that and you say, okay, I've been suffering from an economic recession that really dates back to 50 years back. How do I deal with that? Some of it, the answer is trying to find equity in many of the programs that would immediately address poverty. In Puerto Rico, we talked about the territory having a 43-44% poverty rate, which in my opinion is critically high. It should be a much more urgent matter than what it usually is. That has to do a lot with the work that we do at the Center on Budget, is looking at programs like Medicaid, the Earned Income Tax Credit, the Child Tax Credit, SNAP, and making sure that Puerto Rico has full equity in those programs. And that's critical funding because it ameliorates poverty on the island. It's not, again, a silver bullet. It works as sort of a morphine to treat urgent matters like poverty. Disaster recovery funding is also more morphing to treat or to compensate for all the damages wrought by hurricanes and earthquakes. And, you know, once that morphine goes away, you still have a patient that needs to be stabilized. It needs to be rehabilitated. It needs to run again. And that leads you to the third part, which is Puerto Rico's economic engine or economic identity. What is Puerto Rico's economy going to be about? And for the longest time, it's been a tax haven. You know, first for multinationals and corporations. More recently, it's for individual investors through laws like Act 22, now bundled into Act 60. And I think time has proven that being a tax haven isn't enough. You know, it's led to bankruptcy. It led to a downward economic trend way before that. And I have to mention it, even though it's not an easy topic, but status here plays a big role. I think what the current status allows Puerto Rico to do is it gives it enough autonomy to tinker with fiscal matters, with tax matters in Puerto Rico, but it doesn't give Puerto Rico enough latitude to do all that it would need to do to actually have a properly working economy.
So Javier, let me interject. When you talk about status, can you just expand on that a little bit so the audience knows exactly what you're referring to?
Puerto Rico currently is, for all intents and purposes, a territory of the United States. Officially, the term is Commonwealth. And what that means is that Puerto Rico is subject to the United States Congress and the plenary powers of Congress. It belongs to, but is not a part of the U.S. It's called an unincorporated territory of the United States. In some respect, Puerto Rico has to abide by federal law. And in some very limited instances, it can actually institute its own regime. In economic terms, where Puerto Rico has some degree of independence to do certain things outside of the federal government purview is, again, through fiscal or tax matters. It could tweak certain taxes. It can impose its own income taxes, and it can decide what to do with that. But other than that, Puerto Rico really doesn't have much liberty to do or pursue other economic endeavors outside of the federal realm. And again, as we mentioned before, the treatment of Puerto Rico under the federal regime is not fully equitable. And so you can either move Puerto Rico towards statehood, right, to find full equity in many of the federal programs that we just talked about, or you can try to bestow on Puerto Rico a higher degree of autonomy, perhaps full independence, depending on who you ask, who you poll. And that would also give Puerto Rico certain faculties, certain tools to pursue other economic endeavors that right now it can't under the federal regime. You hear a lot about the Jones Act, for example. Those are some of the laws that wouldn't apply to Puerto Rico if it were given a higher degree of autonomy. I can't tell you which way is the right path. I think both have pros and cons, but what I can tell you is that the current status, the status quo, doesn't seem to be enough for Puerto Rico to have an economy that performs well enough to sustain its population, to lower poverty rates, and now to sustain all the debt obligations that it's taking on as a result of the bankruptcy.
So Javier, two more questions to close out this very fascinating podcast. One is the Jones Act. You mentioned it. Could you just shed a little bit more light on that so people have an understanding? Again, it's an example of the issues that Puerto Rico faces. And then number two, we're talking about the economy. And I just keep coming back to this population migration out of Puerto Rico. And I'm just wondering, well, what's causing that, and how can the economy stabilize if you have more people leaving and you have a high poverty rate? Maybe you can square that circle for me. But first, the Jones Act.
The Jones Act, essentially, in terms of Puerto Rico, is a law that mandates that all imports and exports taking place have to be done through ships with a U.S. flag. So essentially, Puerto Rico, in this case, needs to do all importation and exportation through U.S. merchant ships. And the cost of doing so is incredibly high. And there's been an argument for a long time that if the Jones Act could be exempted in Puerto Rico could trade with the U.S. and other jurisdictions using other merchant ships for a lesser cost. There's also the argument for other jurisdictions in the U.S. By the way, this is not just specific to Puerto Rico, but in the case of the territory, it would have a significant impact. And again, when you look at Puerto Rico, which is an island, it really depends on exports and imports, particularly when you look at food. Puerto Rico has to import 90% of its food. And again, it has to do so using a very costly regime of U.S. merchant ships when it could do so through other means. And to your second question, which is the population question, this, I think, is a key question. From 2010 to 2020, Puerto Rico lost about 500,000 people, which is 15% of its population. A lot of it had to do with the economic recession, and it was exacerbated by the hurricanes in 2017 and the bankruptcy and all the other exogenous shocks that we mentioned. Still today, with Puerto Rico's population, which is currently at about 3.3 million residents, the size is enormous when you think about it. Puerto Rico geographically is a small island, but when you compare it to states, Puerto Rico actually has the 30th most populous jurisdiction in the United States. It has a higher population than 20 other states. So that's no small thing. And the poverty rate remains at 44% because it's a proportional thing. It doesn't matter whether you increase your population or you lose population. It's about, again, the economy, the underlying economy that serves the population, and whether that economy can perform at a level where you can pull people out of poverty. And at this point in time, it is not. And so you have these ebbs and flow in population trends in Puerto Rico. The latest one has been a decreasing trend because, again, Puerto Rico has been through the ringer in recent years. And I think time will tell. And the economy really will tell you whether we have more people moving in or moving out. I know there's been a longstanding critique of the board and its projections about the demographics in Puerto Rico, and they've always predicted that they go down. And a lot of people contend that that is not true. In fact, I have to say this, Puerto Rico's own government has grappled with this, and they don't quite agree with the board that will materialize. They believe that Puerto Rico's population is not going to is not going to decrease as significantly as the board is projecting. I can't tell you what's going to happen population-wise, but what I can tell you is that, again, how Puerto Rico's economy performs is the marker on whether you have a population that grows or sinks in future years.
Thanks, Javier, for providing this critical perspective to what's going on down the island. I mean, obviously, there's all different points of view, but hopefully we helped today shed some light on the complexities involved with understanding Puerto Rico's restructuring. And I look forward to seeing all the great things you do moving forward, Mr. Balmaceda. Thanks again to you for joining us. Thanks to Simone and Greg for their contributions to this week's podcast. To our audience, I hope you found this podcast to be informative. Please support us by liking, sharing, or subscribing to Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. And tune in next Thursday for the latest drop of the Muni Lowdown. Take care. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are solely those of the host and guests. They do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of ION Analytics or any affiliated entities. The information shared in this podcast is for general informational purposes and should not be considered as professional advice.